Then Winston Wheeler versus Commonwealth, Mr. Bailey, Ms. Kiernan again.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Kevin Bailey from Lynchburg. I represent the appellant, Mr. Lynn Winston Wheeler, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
You may. Thank you.
In the case of Mr. Wheeler, there was no proof of exigent circumstances to justify a warrantless search of his home, and the evidence seized should have been suppressed. Now, the trial court, in rendering its ruling, when it ruled on the motion to suppress, it stated there were three legal theories, at least three legal theories, that would have justified the warrantless entry. I addressed those in my brief, and I would like to focus today on the Commonwealth's arguments from their brief. They pointed out two exceptions. Number one, they said that the destruction of evidence permitted the warrantless entry. And number two, they argued in their brief that the emergency situation permitted the warrantless entry. The argument that the destruction of blood evidence or other evidence before a warrant could be obtained is asserted as a pretext and without merit in this case. The trial court...
You seem to argue in your brief that the exigent circumstance exception only applies if there is contraband that might be destroyed, but does not apply to evidence that might be destroyed. Am I misreading that, or is that what you're putting forward?
That is the general theme of what I'm arguing, Your Honors, but I think the idea can come about, and I think a good argument can be made that perhaps in certain cases, if the destruction of evidence is going to take place, then law enforcement has the ability to go in without a warrant. And the Commonwealth did a good job of referencing that.
So if exigent circumstances apply, if the police have probable cause to believe that evidence might be destroyed, and if, as here, there is clear evidence that some destruction of the blood had at least been attempted, why weren't the police at least entitled to go in and secure the premises while they obtained a warrant?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, you have to analyze the case law, and you have to look at the facts of the case. The Commonwealth references the West v. Commonwealth case, and in that case, there was the potential for the destruction of evidence, and they seized an object. They seized a pair of pants with blood on it. They seized it without a warrant, and the court upheld that seizure and said that that evidence could have been destroyed. And when you look at the facts of that case, we had in that case, the West case, a rape that took place. The victim called the law enforcement and told the law enforcement that I've been raped, I believe it's that guy, and I've been injured, and he's been injured. So they go and they knock on his door, he comes out, and he has the injuries that are consistent with the injuries that she talked about in her interview with him. Then he's going to be transported. He tries to shut the door in the officer's face. They then step in to arrest him. They're going to take him down to the station. He doesn't have any pants on. And his mother brings him a pair of pants, and there's blood on it. Well, they immediately seize that. And the court upheld that and said that that's the kind of evidence. If law enforcement had to go and get a warrant and left him there, then he would have destroyed that evidence. But that evidence is different than the evidence we have in this particular case. And so you have to look at...
Well, does it make a difference what type of evidence might be destroyed?
I believe it does, most definitely, Your Honor, because to say that if evidence is at a crime scene, and so we're going to go ahead and secure the premises and go right on in, then we have...
Well, that's not exactly what we're saying. We're saying that there's probable cause to believe that evidence might be destroyed.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we have testimony here that evidence, albeit outside the house, was in fact destroyed.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think we have to look at what evidence we have. We have testimony that there was blood on the sidewalk that had been cleaned up. We're dealing with a case where a man had been shot. He went in the house. There was no question about that. He asked for help. She gave him a towel and sent him down to the hospital. He bled going up the sidewalk. It is arguably, he bled inside the house.
And so, arguably?
I think it's a very good inference that he bled inside the house. And
well, do you agree that it was reasonable for the officers at that moment, that they were at the house, to have viewed that as a crime scene?
I believe it was a crime scene.
Okay.
And I think the court's reasoning there was sound, that it was a crime scene. But the court in Robertson, the Supreme Court of the United States has been very clear, the courts of the Commonwealth have been very clear, there is not a general crime scene exception. And I understand your comments, Your Honor, that in this case is not just a crime scene. There's probable cause that evidence has been destroyed. But is there probable cause that evidence is being destroyed in the house? And I would say that there's not probable cause.
You don't think a police officer can reach the logical conclusion that if someone in the house attempted to destroy evidence outside the house, they may well be attempting to destroy evidence inside the house? Is that an unreasonable inference to make?
Your Honor, that is possible. We have to look at the facts of this particular case. The officers have the individual who admitted to cleaning up the blood evidence. She's standing there on the porch.
They know there's other people in the house, don't they?
Well, they don't when they're having this conversation. They later determine there to be people in the house because they hear voices.
Well, in fact, one of the officers, as I recall, heard quieted, hushed voices, and the kind that may suggest that perhaps the assailant was still in the house and there was something more going on there.
Your Honor, in cross-examination of Officer Doobie, I asked him if the voices were consistent with normal conversation. He testified that he did, that they were, that they were just normal voices, not that they were hushed voices. The Commonwealth, in their brief, misstates the facts and actually says that they were low voices. That's the way they characterize the voices.
Difference does it make whether they were hushed, low, loud, shouts? The fact of the matter is they established that there were people in the house.
Well, it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about whether destroying evidence, it matters. If we're talking about whether there's an emergency situation, it matters what type of voices were being heard in the house. But as to the destruction of evidence, the evidence as they're seeing it, the case as it unfolds to them, they're there talking with the person that's destroying, that has washed away the blood. There's nothing that suggests that there's another person inside the house continuing to clean up the place. What we had Miss Jewel Allen testify that she cleaned up. She cleaned up the blood in her house. She cleaned up the blood on the sidewalk. And now they're here asking her about it. And as a pretext for their entry, they said, well, we were trying to preserve the blood evidence. But I'd like to go back to the West case because there's a big difference. The blood evidence in that case on the pants created a nexus, if you will, between the assailant and the victim. And we don't have that at all in this case. We've got the victim down at the local hospital, and we have his blood on the sidewalk. We have no idea who the assailant is. We don't even know for sure if there is an assailant. He could have shot himself. He doesn't tell the officers anything. So there's no nexus between the victim and a particular perpetrator. We just have blood. And I believe that to say that, well, it's blood, perhaps they're cleaning it, maybe someone is in the house cleaning it, is to further extend West, and we're bordering on a general crime scene exception. And I'd ask the court to guard against that. I think we're getting on dangerous grounds when we extend West. It was a very particular case, and we do not have those facts here in this particular case.
Did West involve just a protective sweep such as this, or did that involve an actual entry and search?
In the West case, Your Honor, the police officers went to the door to question the alleged perpetrator, and he's there with injuries consistent with those that were explained to the officers.
But what did the police do when they went in the house?
They were going to arrest him right then. He shut the door on the police and they went in to get him. And they were going to arrest him. They had probable cause to arrest him because here he is with injuries consistent.
What type of search did they make? Did they go in the house and search for things?
Your Honor, I'm not sure of the answer to that question, but they seized a pair of pants that were given to them in the course of arresting him. That's where the issue arose. The pants they took were taken without a warrant. The pants were given to this man who obviously was there in his underwear, didn't have pants on.
But you talk about a general crime scene search, and when I think of a general crime scene search, I think of exactly that, when the police enter a house and start looking in every nook and cranny searching for evidence. This case, to me, all they did was go in and make sure that there was no one in the house that would either hurt them or tamper with the evidence, and then they went down and secured a search warrant and conducted the search. I see a big difference between those two scenarios.
Yes, sir. In this particular case, when they entered the house, they didn't subsequently ask for a warrant because there's evidence being destroyed, which I believe would be typically how a law enforcement should do it. They didn't. It was only after they found the contraband there in the house.
In plain view.
In plain view that they asked for the warrant. So this idea, there was blood evidence being destroyed.
When they went in the house, they didn't start looking in drawers and cupboards and closets and under the rug. They simply went through the house looking for occupants and discovered in plain view the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, we cite two cases that I think are important to note. The Reed case, it lists five factors on whether law enforcement can go in to prevent the destruction of evidence. And then I cite also a Virginia case, Your Honor, the Verez v. Commonwealth case. In both of those cases, when the court was questioned and asked to determine whether it was appropriate to go in to prevent the destruction of evidence, both cases says, let's look at the urgency of it. Well, think about the urgency in this case. We've got a man who was shot 30 minutes or perhaps more time has elapsed. They're there. There's blood of the victim on the sidewalk. Then they hear voices in the house. Where's the urgency? In the Reed case, the police went to the house. They see a man asleep, and there's a sawed-off shotgun sitting by his feet. And the court said, that's contraband. They had the right to go in and immediately get it because it created a precarious situation. It's dangerous. But also in both those cases, the Verez case and the Reed case, they talk about contraband over and over and over again. And we don't have contraband here. What we have is blood evidence. And so the case I think on point would be the West case. And I think I think distinguished that case. We don't have a nexus between a perpetrator and the victim. We just have blood. And so the Commonwealth come in after the fact and say, well, there was perhaps some blood being destroyed. Well, in any crime scene, there is the potential for evidence to be destroyed, whether it dissipates, whether it is washed away, cleaned away, but that does not give police officers, under the guise of there's a risk it'll be destroyed, the freedom to go in and to look around.
But the element that's missing in your scenario that justifies a protective sweep, which is what I think the court was talking about in freezing of the status quo, is the belief that there's also other people present in the house. You can't conduct a protective sweep if there's nobody else in the house to protect yourself from.
Yes, sir.
But here they know there's people in the house.
Your Honor, the analysis of a protective sweep is not appropriate in this particular case because there was not an arrest made. And so the court is talking.
Why do you believe that an arrest must be made in order for there to be a protective sweep? I've never found that to be one of the requirements.
Well, Your Honor, when studying the case law on protective sweep, that seems to be one of the elements necessary, that an arrest has to be made. In this case, we don't have it.
It's a fact that an arrest might have been made. I think our most recent en banc case involved a person who was arrested at the door, and there was a gun remaining in the house. And yeah, he was arrested, but that had nothing to do with the analysis of protective sweep. It was, A, is there evidence in the house, and B, are there possibly people in the house that might tamper with that evidence hurt the police officers?
Yes, sir. And, Your Honor, I would suggest in this particular case there was no threat up to the police officers. There was no real risk that evidence was to be destroyed. The officers were there having a conversation with this lady, and she was telling them about everything that had happened, told them about the shooting. And so they're there on scene, and I would say, where's the real risk? There's no cries for help. There's just normal.
Mr. Bailey, I venture to guess that there's very few police officers that would tell you that they were on the crime scene where someone had been shot and they didn't consider any person in that house a potential threat. I mean, that's just common sense.
Your Honor, if in a case where someone has been murdered in a home, that does not give the police the right to just go in. Sure, the murderer could be lurking nearby in the bushes, but they cannot go in absent some exception to the warrant requirement. And so we have to guard against that. I mean, that is a fundamental right, and that's the per se rule, that all searches are unreasonable. And that's the reason we're bringing this matter before the court.
Your time has expired. I hit you with a lot of questions, so I'll give you a couple moments, minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Kiernan?
Good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the court, Elizabeth Kiernan on behalf of the Commonwealth. The officers in this case did have the exigencies required to enter the premises under, as my opponent mentioned, because they had probable cause and because they believed that evidence was about to be destroyed inside the house, and also because they were facing an emergency situation. As Judge Petty noted, they received information from dispatch that someone had been shot on Lorraine Street. They approached this house. There's a wet patch outside on the sidewalk smelling freshly of bleach. There is a trail of blood leading to the front door. There's a shooter on the loose. When the police officers speak to Ms. Allen, she says that a man who was bleeding had been inside the house. She gave him a towel and sent him on his way. This would give the police officers reason to believe there was additional blood inside the house. Furthermore, the police officers aren't required to take Ms. Allen at her word. The trial judge found that her behavior was extremely suspicious. There's no way for the police officers to know whether the blood is the victim at the hospital, whether there's another man involved. What they do know is that someone has been shot and seriously injured, and it appears the shooting happened on this property.
Ms. Kiernan, let me raise this point. We're probably stuck with the analysis that the trial court used in concluding this was a reasonable search. And he talked about the hot pursuit and the exigent circumstance, and then he talked about the freezing of the status quo warrantless entry. Do you read that? Do you find in that description any distinction from what I would normally call the protective sweep exception? I mean, are we looking at the same requirements of knowledge on the part of a police officer to, quote, freeze the status quo as opposed to conduct a protective sweep?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the trial judge's reasoning was sound, regardless of what he termed the exception that he was using. And this court does evaluate probable cause and reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment de novo. So if this court is able to reach beyond what the trial court found in that regard, and obviously has an obligation to affirm on any basis present in the record, particularly with that de novo review, I think that gives the court a little bit more leeway to go outside the trial judge's interpretation of law in this case. But his reasoning, I believe, was sound in that regard, that there was evidence inside the house, there were people inside the house, there was at least one person who had already begun to destroy evidence. She had destroyed evidence outside. She couldn't have been bothered to call the police or provide aid for her housemate, but she could get out of bed to pour bleach on her sidewalk. Presumably, she would also have cleaned up whatever was inside the house as well. And while she was outside, there were additional people inside that residence, and they didn't know who these people were. They could have been victims, they could have been shooters, they could have been accomplices. It's a rapidly evolving situation, and the police officers are dealing with probabilities, not with certainties in that situation.
Do we have to spend much time addressing the hot pursuit exception? Does that really apply?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't know what they would have been in hot pursuit of at this point, since there wasn't.
You just shortened our opinion. Thank you.
Sure.
Do you think the West case has any applicability here? It seems to be an important foundation for part of the defense argument.
Sure, Your Honor. I believe the West case is important in two regards, in that it establishes what this court already knows, and that's blood evidence, DNA evidence is readily disposable. We have that same kind of evidence in this case. It also establishes that when the defendant in that case knew the police were there, knew the police were coming, and I believe the court also noted he could see the police at the victim's house across the way. Likewise, in this case, the police were on the front porch. The people inside the house knew the police were there. Certainly, Ms. Allen and Taylor knew the police were there as well. So for those two reasons, but I think the analogy does stop there. And that's why we were relying on the case for the destructibility of that evidence, and also for the reasonable inference the police officers could draw that these people were aware of their presence and could be destroying evidence inside the house. Yes, ma'am. Sure. And the police officers, or the Commonwealth rather, does not have to come forward with concrete proof that evidence was about to be destroyed or was on the verge of being destroyed.
It's more of a question of probabilities, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
On the prong of finding probable cause, probability analysis extends to whether there were sufficient exigent circumstances to warrant the entry without a warrant as well. Probabilities? I think we have cases that say it really doesn't have to be evidence, concrete evidence that the evidence is in there to
Correct, Your Honor. It turns on what an objective officer could reasonably believe. And the court used that standard in Cherry and also in Smith. Both of those cases did involve drug paraphernalia, but like contraband, DNA evidence, blood evidence is easily destroyed. And the police officers in this case reasonably could presume that it would be if they left to obtain a warrant. If the court were to find that there was not probable cause in this case, certainly the Commonwealth believes that there is. The officers could have also entered the house under the emergency exception, which is a separate type of exigent circumstances.
Except doesn't that require some factual findings by the trial court that we don't have here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the trial court recognized that there was a man in the hospital that had been shot. There was a shooter on the loose. The police officers were investigating that shooting. There was a trail of blood on the sidewalk leading up to the house. And the trial court specifically noted that Ms. Allen was behaving very suspiciously. The trial court found her actions were evasive and that she hadn't called the police.
It's been suggested to us that we not apply the right result, wrong reason analysis very often. Don't we have some problem applying that where the trial court never even addressed the issue?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I believe the court doesn't have to reach the emergency exception because the probable cause and exigent circumstances argument is strong in this case. But to apply the right result for the wrong reason, the court needs the fact findings, which are there in this case. I believe the things we just went through, those were all factual findings. The court relied on those in different ways. But this court does have an obligation, again, to affirm on any basis present in the record. And those facts are there. They are present. And the determination of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment is de novo. So this court could go beyond the legal determinations of the trial court and reach that emergency exception if the court was inclined to do so. Unless the court has further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment.
No, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bailey, I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. Your Honors, at some point, when the police officers fear the destructibility, the evidence is going to be destroyed, at some point, in certain cases, they're justified in going in and making a warrantless search. The court found that in the West case. My argument today is that the court has to draw the line somewhere. In any case, there is a chance that evidence can be destroyed. And so where do we draw the line? In the West case, they had probable cause to believe that this particular pair of pants could have been destroyed. And so they seized it without a warrant. In that particular case, we were dealing with a rape, we were dealing with blood evidence, we were dealing with DNA evidence, and we had a link between the victim and the perpetrator. And the idea that we're going to let him...
Don't you have here blood that was in the process of being destroyed? At least, arguably, probably.
Your Honor...
If a reasonable officer could have concluded that there was blood that was in the process of being destroyed inside the house, because it already had been destroyed outside the house. I don't know why West would be inconsistent with that. In West, the blood was on a pair of jeans that they had already found.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court could draw different kinds of conclusions, but they're consistent with the principle that I think is at work here.
Well, the idea in West is we've got evidence linking this man, this perpetrator of the crime.
Understood your argument there.
And in this particular case, it's just blood of a known victim. And he's bled, and it's his blood, and she's already cleaned it up. She's already cleaned it in the house and outside the house.
But the crime was committed.
The crime was committed, and we have no evidence that it was committed in the house.
Well, there's some probability that it could have been.
There is a chance that it could have been. A neighbor said she heard a pop, sounded like a trash can being turned over.
So if we're in the area of probabilities, as opposed to certainties, you don't have, you don't need a certainty that it was there committed.
Your Honor, where the crime was committed, if you had knowledge that it was committed in the house, that could weigh into the calculation.
I don't know that they had knowledge in that sense.
I would argue that they didn't. The testimony is he went into the house to get Miss Allen to take him out.
Excuse me.
Can I have an extra 5 minutes?
Just, I must have accidentally pushed a button on the phone here. Excuse me for my apologize.
He went into the house.
Do not disturb. That's what. Now you may proceed.
Miss Allen doesn't testify that she hears a gunshot and in the home. She testifies, this man, my roommate, my housemate, comes in the house asking for help. I give him a towel. So, and then there's a neighbor that hears that the trash can, hears a sound that sounds like a loud pop. And so, to answer your question, where the crime occurred is a factor, but in this case, there's not an idea in the police officer's head, maybe they're destroying other evidence. There is perhaps the idea that they're destroying blood, but they never even collected blood.
All right, Mr. Bailey, you need to bring a conclusion, please.
Judge, we've discussed the issue of destroying evidence. I've argued in my brief about the emergency. I don't think it's there. No one was in fear.
Quickly bring it to conclusion,
please.
I'm
going to ask the court reverse the decision and find that suppression was that the lack of suppression is inappropriate.
Thank you very much.